Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Hello and welcome to episode 230 of the Chills of Will podcast. Pleasure today to be joined by Chelsea T. Hicks. A little bit about Chelsea. She's a Wajaje writer with an MA from UC Davis and an MFA from the Institute of American Indian Arts. Her writing has been published in the Parish Review, Poetry, McSweeney's, and elsewhere. She was selected as a 5 Under 35 honoree by Louise Erdrich for the National Book Award. And her first book, A Calm and Normal Heart, was longlisted for the Pen America Robert W. Bingham Prize. Chelsea, good morning slash afternoon. How are you?
Good. It's so good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for being on. It's awesome to talk to you. Go Aggies. I'm here in Sacramento. UC Davis. Hopefully it was a good experience. And maybe I'm asking the question, you're like, it was a terrible experience, but.
No, I had an amazing mentor there, Lucy Corin. And I was shaped by a lot of the writers there as well. Pam Houston, Ian Lee. And so, I mean, it was great.
That's awesome. UC Davis, I don't think has an MFA, right? So was that an MA in English or what would be the.
They do have an MFA now, It's only a few years old. Okay. When I graduated in 2017, they were a couple years out from creating that. And it was a critical / creative MA in English.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. Go Aggies, like I said.
Yeah.
535, you know, National Book Award, Louise Erdrich, any of those words together is pretty dang cool. What was that like to be selected for that as someone who's kind of like, oh, she's up and coming, but like you've arrived, like your book is, your collection is great. It's not like, it's like potential. What was that like?
It was shocking. Like, Peter, I can't tell you, like, I felt like when my book came out, it was received well critically, but not necessarily per se popularly, so to speak. Like, visibility, sales, awareness, conversation. Like, I noticed it in the Native community. It was definitely like more appreciated and talked about than just in the wider literary community per se. I'm not saying overall that it wasn't, but I would see it being viewed as a bit more experimental. And like one person on Goodreads that I thought was really funny, they said it was MFA core. And I was like, okay, that's funny because I thought I was writing it in like a really direct kind of anti-literary rules style, so to speak. But after you go through so much, I guess, education and quote assimilation to the literary standards, maybe you can't really ever shake it, even if you thought you did. And, so I was shocked is like an understatement. Like I couldn't believe that when I got that call, I wasn't expecting like to really win any awards. And it meant everything, you know, and it was because of Louise Erdrich that she nominated it for that at the National Book Foundation, the 535. And I mean, I was just, and I am still so, so grateful because, I mean, I don't know about you and your perspective on it, but how I have kind of felt in going around the festival circuit and the reading, you know, the reading tour or whatever, I've kind of felt like I've had a bit of a coming to terms with reality of like how open people or excited people really are to reading short stories about like, oh, Native American women. Like I thought people would be like, oh, that's interesting. That's exciting. But instead, it kind of felt like it was this burden of conscience thing. And like, oh, that's awkward. Like, oh, that's not that's not like our native, what? And so I was like, oh no, I'm like, I'm not popular, you know, like I'm like this like weird beggar. And so that's to kind of put it in perspective, like I feel like, you know, you get that idea, you hear that with people of color in general type of thing, and BIPOC, you know, kind of framework that we have now of more inclusion. But I guess I was a little bit shocked to realize like maybe where people are coming from in terms of how they relate to or even think about or know about Native American women at all. And some of those, I mean, I don't know, but it was just a little bit of a like a disappointment, I guess, in releasing this book and realizing maybe where the public is at, so to speak, and how much work there is to do.
Oh, I appreciate that. So when you talk about the burden of conscience, I thought maybe you were saying like a lot of the readers were maybe like kind of performative and like, oh, I should be reading something like this.
No, I don't think so. I just think that when I'm referring more to when people like come to the book, it's like the reason people might pick it up is because like, oh, this is important. This is like something I should read about, not per se something that's like, oh, that sounds exciting or fun or fascinating. It was more like, oh, this is this like thing that I could read to like be a good citizen, but most people may be, you know, not going to make that choice because in your literary time, that's kind of for me, my me time. And, you know, I'm going to choose what I just want to read.
Well, yeah, to say the book is not, I mean, there's definitely a lot of traumas and a lot of dark areas and depression and anger and misogyny, but there's some really fun parts in there too.
Right. That's
All
how
right.
I, what I hoped
All
I would be bringing, but I guess I was like, oh, I'm
right.
bringing the, you know, moral to-do list. Great.
Oh man. There's polyamory, right? There's singing, there's songwriting, there's Hollywood setups, there's a lot of cool like road trips. There's definitely community. We'll talk more about that in a minute, but
Well, I'm
okay.
grateful to you for framing it as the fun I hope it's being.
It is. So yeah, I wonder about, I mean, I think from what I've read about you that you've really, well, you say it in the author's note that you've really looked to kind of with a lot of other Osage and natives in particular, indigenous people in particular, is to really like revitalize, and that's the word you use in your author's note, revitalize the language. I wonder, are you someone grown up who understood everything in the language, who understood little, who, because of assimilation and forced English was, never learned anything until older. Like, what's your relationship with the language, especially growing up?
Yeah, there's like there's a lot of information to provide here to give like the facts. So I'll just go ahead and reference that and I'll try to give the short story. And for anybody who wants all the details, I did a profile in Cowboys and Indians magazine that goes into like exactly how all this came to be over a few generations. But l long story short, Osage language today is like being revitalized, which means that we didn't have speakers until now we have some, and I'm one of those people. And so growing up, there would have definitely been, I was born in 1990, there I heard Osage language from some of our elders speaking at the Elanska or praying at a meal. And our language was kind of used in that way. I did not grow up inside of Native American church, but if I had, or if I had grown up in Osage County attending, there's a Baptist church there that was founded by the Redcorn family, and they have some services or some hymns in Osage language. So it's not that there was no Osage language being spoken while I was growing up, but for most Osage people, the only things that you might be hearing are a few phrases in Osage throughout your daily life, if that. So I did hear some phrases in my, like I called my grandmother, I didn't call her Nan, I called her Iko, which means grandmother. And I didn't call my mom is non-native. I didn't call her Ina, which is means mom. I didn't call my dad Edenotzi Indazi. I called them mom and dad. And my Iko or my grandma would say some things to us in Osage. Like, particularly, I remember if we were like doing something wrong, she would go, Fiji. And she would like rub the back of her hand. And that means like, it's like a scolding, like you're being bad.
Like
And
tisk tisk or something like that.
I guess, yeah. And so that was what I heard growing up. And I don't think I would have ever taken the initiative to learn Osage, just like going along my way of how I had been, sort of the path I was on, except that two big things happened. When my eco passed away, I was just about to go into school or had just started school at UC Davis in like 2015. And it impacted me like, I mean, really severely. Like I started having kind of these mental health crises that felt inexplicable. It was like something had been passed down or something had been held back. And then when she passed away, there's all these things going on for me in my family and in my personal life that I needed to kind of address and work through. And so part of that was that I ended up having to go like to just seek mental health services because I was kind of in a crisis. And the services I could access were at the Native American Health Center in Richmond, California. And they were like, I was going to talking circles and meeting with elders. And they were telling me, like, well, the only way that you're going to like basically like be okay and heal is you need to learn your traditions. And so I was just kind of trying to do that, but I didn't really exactly know how. Or so I was just trying to do that. That was like this thing I was seeking. And then meanwhile, at UC Davis, I was in this seminar course in Native poetry with Inez Hernandez Avila, who's a Nez Perce and Tejana woman, who's a translator as well of
You shouted
like,
out her in the acknowledgments, I believe, right?
right. So yeah, she passed along this message from poets in Oaxaca and Chiapas, and they were like, they wanted to challenge through her to us writers, Native writers in North America. They were like, why are you not writing in your languages? And I was like, what? It's in oral language and no one knows it. Why would I be writing in it? I was like all offended. But then that same spring, an app came out from our tribe
Whoa.
with how to learn the language. It was like a language learning app. And I was like, oh my gosh. And I had always liked learning languages, just like French. My mom's family is from New Orleans and they're Creole and they're mixed. And so I had always attached to French as this way to like try to have a stronger identity, because I'm also from the band of the tribe that in Osage is kind of called Half Breed Band. And it's like this kind of super French Osage descendancy line that comes from a time in St. Louis history when our tribe was located in Missouri and trade networks of power. And we had these marriages between French fur traders and the third daughter of Chief Pahuska.
Oh,
And so
wow.
I'm like coming directly from that. And I have French heritage on both sides of my family. So I had always had this like language learning identity question. And so I was like, okay, well, I'm going to try to learn Osage. And I had been working right after I graduated Davis. I went in randomly into working at a multilingual curriculum program at UC Santa Cruz, which the whole goal was to learn really rapidly. Students learn a language. So I started reading all this research and was teaching classes on it and was exposed to these methods of learning quickly. So I kind of just threw myself into it, and it totally like was the pathway toward more healing and reconnection. And it led me to moving back to Oklahoma. And I just basically was able to like resolve my issues a lot. And I'm like, save my life kind of thing.
Wow.
So,
The beauty of language.
yeah.
My gosh, the saving powers of language. Oh, man. Well, thanks so much for sharing that. So you made your way around the UCs, so the banana slugs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the greatest mascot
Totally.
ever.
Yeah.
What is being you said that you taught it, and I believe you teach still, like this idea of being able to teach. I mean, are you teaching the Osage language? Or are you teaching
Oh no,
language acquisition in
sorry.
general?
So I was teaching during the pandemic. I was, and before the pandemic, I worked at our immersion school. So that's what was the next step after teaching the multilingual. It was teaching methods of learning a language quickly.
Right,
That's what
right, right, right.
And then
Okay.
I worked at our immersion school. My job was to help, along with Osage linguist Cameron Pratt, to help bring more Osage into the curriculum. And then during the pandemic, I was kind of questioning what I want to do. And like, I didn't feel like that was my aptitude or kind of compatible for me to work in like schools with that. Cause I like a little bit more like freedom and autonomy with my schedule. And now I'm a reporter at Osage News and I really like, but during the pandemic I had, taught like at IAIA, Institute of American Indian Arts, which I did an MFA there, of course. And I taught in their continuing ed program about how to, just sharing what I was doing for myself. Basically, we called it language learning acceleration methods. And it was called like learning our languages. And, I have now with some friends, we've founded a 501c3 called Words of the People, and it's all around promoting Indigenous language creative production. And so I do still teach workshops through that, but I'm not kind of teaching as like my profession anymore. And like, so much respect for you. I can't do it anymore. I would get, I don't know about you, but like, I used to be a performer like in bands and stuff, and I don't do that anymore. But when I was teaching, it was something similar for me where I would like get hyped up like a huge amount, and it took a long time for me to like come down. And so it's like, I like relating to people, but one-on-one in the news is easier for me than kind of, you know, the whole classroom. And I just couldn't quite ever adjust to it. So I had to kind of take a new path, but I mean, amazing though. I do love it, and it's beautiful.
Are we talking like lead singer of a band kind of thing, or guitarist, or
I was the keyboardist and the singer for a series of bands from Washington DC to San Francisco. And
Dang.
The only place that you can still hear our music is in like this one article. I was married at the time, so I think, and I'm divorced now, but I think my name in there was like Chelsea H. Bryan, and I'll send you the link because like that's the only place you can hear our music anymore is in that like
Oh, that's pretty
article by SF Weekly.
Try not to sound like cheesy about it. Like, is there something, I'm half Italian and I'm like third generation, right? And it's you know, the same kind of thing where it's like, you know, they were taught speak English, right?
Right.
And so unfortunately,
it is like
very
that.
Right. I mean, very little got down, and this that had nothing to do with, I mean, or very little, if anything, to do with, you know, government oppression as happened with like the Osage. But like when I went to Italy, and I do speak Spanish, you know, which is similar, but like I did feel like a connection, you know, I did feel like it was, is that something that you feel, again, without, I'm trying not to make it like cheesier, but
I think
like,
exactly what you're saying.
I mean, how would you describe, like, probably just understanding things that you almost like have no business understanding? Do you know what I mean? Like, you wouldn't have that language background, but it just kind of like makes sense to you. Have you felt that with the language in particular?
Well, what do you mean the part about, like, can you say more about like no business understanding it?
Well, like when I was there, again, with my Spanish background, but still, like, I got along okay somehow.
I see.
You know, like I read here and there and learned Italian here and there, and grandma spoke a little bit, but you know what I mean? Like, I really had no business understanding that much.
Right.
Does that
No.
Make sense?
Okay. So what you're talking about with just like a bit of an innate familiarity that just automatically comes together and like an aptitude, I have that feeling about living here in Oklahoma and being with the tribe. Like, I didn't grow up in Oklahoma, but I am just like, when I'm here, I feel like I'm where I'm supposed to be. I am so happy. But with the language, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's not similar to French, or it's not similar to English. And the word order is different. The handling of pronouns, the animacy, the structure and grammar of the language, it's like, it is so mind-blowingly different. Once I really started getting into it, I actually felt like my mind was being kind of gently torn apart and like re, so it was like, It was a mind blown experience. It wasn't easy, but I don't know if that's the same for everyone. But I do think that in terms of the concepts and the understanding, that once I'm learning that, I feel like I'm coming home to something that I haven't known for a long time, but it feels very right. So it's like yes and no.
Right.
Maybe
I
with your
appreciate it.
Spanish, you know, you're like, and you're, you know, whatever you got passed down through your Nona or whoever.
Sure. I can remember one part of the collection where the woman gives the Osage word, and it for red, and it's a cool, I think it basically is saying like a combination of white and purple or something like that. That's red.
Oh,
No, so
it's
red's not exactly.
pink. Pink,
Sure.
combination of
Sure.
red and white. Yeah. Jiu-Jitsu Echo, yellow and orange mixed, or Z, yellow, Jiu-Jitsu red,
Oh,
Echo,
wow.
like that. So orange is yellow and red.
Well, it's like in Arabic, I'm probably even underplaying it. There are like 15 ways to say I love you. I just, language can be obviously so evocative. Like, does the Osage language have masculine, feminine?
No, we don't. There, well, yes and no. There's a
Okay.
femme way of speaking to
Oh,
project
wow.
femininity or to speak in a female way.
Huh.
We have mihoge, a word meaning follows the moon or gay or lesbian or you know perhaps today contemporarily two spirit. I understand that to mean that you can operate in either role of a man or a woman in ceremony. That was Alex Droyn who told me that. Like, I don't identify as mihoge, although I'm bisexual, but I, in our language, we don't have pronouns that are
Okay.
gendered. Our pronouns are not gendered.
Wow.
So it is different in that way.
I remember, unfortunately, probably the author not to be spoken of, but talking about, and he wasn't the first to say it, but just the idea that I think the quote was something about his group, his tribe, his native group assimilated into homophobia.
Yes.
Just this idea, right, that it's colonialism in many ways. It's Eurocentric. It's not always, things have not always been this way. You were talking about following the moon. How cool is that?
I
As
know.
in, like, whatever kind of moves you that day, almost, or that night. You know what I
When
mean?
I think about that, I think about how a woman, you know, has a moon cycle and also how water, you know, like your period, and also how the moon itself moves waters and tides. As well as the fact that, you know, the moon or the word mi in mihoge, mi is a word for the sun. And so I also think of it as a celestial body. And so I also think about our cosmology and how sensitivity to looking at the stars and meditating on the planets and what's happening is an ancient form. And so I think of mihoge personally, you know, as people who are almost sensitive to or watching astrology, who watch the river cycles, who watch the moon cycles, who are attuned to the upper world.
Right.
And that's how I think about it. It's nobody told me to think about it that way, but just linguistically, that's my personal kind of meditations on it.
One of my favorite slash least favorite classes in college was linguistics.
Oh,
Least,
I took
right?
a linguistics class too, and I got a C, I think, which was like devastating for me because I
Well,
was like, you know, Miss Student.
least favorite, right? Because a lot of it was like very, I don't know, biological, like what part of the throat do you use for this and glottal sounds and all that. But some of it, linguistics is so cool. Like, particular cultures, languages, or dialects don't have a future tense. You know, what does
True.
that mean about, what does that say about the history and so many cool
I'm
things
with
there,
you. I found
right?
out I like applied linguistics more, and that's kind of these theories and these research and testing of how do you learn or revitalize a language and all that. I do like that part, but I'm still too afraid to go study that more. It's hard.
I wonder about your literary journey as far as from being, all the way from being a kid to now. Who are some of the really formative and transformative writers or texts that you've read over these years?
Wow. Oh, when I was really little, I liked reading Winnie the
Oh,
Pooh.
yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I think that maybe the sense of humor, like I've been told, that there's like some jokes in my stuff, and like I write that way to entertain myself, like everything I'm doing all the time, I'm always joking for the most part, unless I'm mad. But like I read Peter Pan when I was like J.M. Barrie, when I was maybe 12 or 13, and I loved this idea of like them living in this fantasy world. And like the whole portrayal of natives in that book is so problematic. Like they actually sing, like they're speaking about language, they portray language as ugga wugga meatball. Like that's how the native language sounds. And like that was my orientation toward like native literature and being native growing up. I think there was a lot of like internalized racism because I lived in Virginia, and my dad would build for the, he's a builder, so he would build for the Rappahannock tribe. So I met like their chief and kids, playing with kids on the reservation there. And so I didn't have this idea of myself as like, oh, I'm not a regular whole perfect native because I'm growing up in Virginia. Like I was very confident in my native identity, but that didn't mean that what I saw in the kids I grew up around at school made me like lean into it, because it was kind of like, oh, do you guys go on vacation? Or we went to the beach. And it's like, oh, you went to Oklahoma and you went and you're Native American. Oh, let me see your regalia. Oh, Osage regalia. Like, people didn't have Killers of the Flower Moon, so they're like, they see Osage regalia and they're like, that's not Native American. Like, people are just like, it's that same reaction I feel I almost get today. It's like when they're like Native woman, they're like, what? Like, that's not what they told us in school. And in school they told us, like, I remember reading it in the textbook, they're like, most Native American people and the cultures, they're dead, they're gone. And I was like, so I was very confused just from school, let alone I had this other thing with my mom being always worried about things being pagan, which is kind of ironic with her coming from New Orleans. And so she was always like warning me, like, oh, you can participate in this ceremonial dances, or you can do this powwow, but you just need to keep Jesus in your mind, and this is pagan, and you need to be careful. And I was like, oh my God. So I was just so confused. So like I totally wasn't interested in like native stuff. I felt like I was afraid to learn about it because, oh no, it's pagan. And I was very confused. And so I was just reading, my dad actually, maybe I don't know if you're gonna be like this with your kids, but maybe you'll learn something from my experience. He was like, he would assign me books to read. Like I had to read what he chose. Like he was basically making me read the canon, and I could read two books of my own choice for whatever one book he was having me read. So I was reading, like whatever from the canon, Jane Eyre when I was 13. I did like that. But whatever, like I was just reading basically what, and he would have me write these essays, like, and we had to work as a construction business too. So I did not want to write the essays. I was like super angry, but I was afraid of him, so I didn't like, run away. So I was kind of like pushed to be a writer, I think. But I did write poetry on my own that I didn't share with anybody, and that was coming from me. And I liked reading dragon books. But the first time that I like really, really had something touch me on a really deep level that was just beyond, oh, it's touching me in one way or another, like stylistically. The one with Zoe and Franny, what's that one?
Yeah, Salinger, right? Franny and Zoe, I think. Yeah. I've not read it, but yeah,
I
definitely.
liked that. I liked Edith Wharton, but I think these people, I could never relate to it like wholly. There was something about it I liked, but I wasn't like all the way in on it,
Would you have been able to articulate that you didn't feel,
No.
fully there
I mean, you could
at the
tell,
time?
you could have, if you'd seen it in happening, like as a dramatized.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was this guy at my church named Graham Winings, and he was 2 years older than me. We were kind of like, I wasn't allowed to date, but we were kind of like, flirtations. And he would like also, you should read this book. Like this will open your mind about drugs. And I was just like, what? And so, like I think the way that I responded to him about those books, maybe it was evident in my response, like, yeah, it's cool. It's okay. Like it's pretty good.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's I think as far, but I don't think I would have been able to articulate it because I didn't have anything really by strong comparison until I
Sure.
read The Way to Rainy Mountain by M. Scott Momaday, and I was like, that really opened my eyes because it mirrored to me something I had always felt about plants and like plants being like basically alive. And I was afraid to tell people because the two worst things in my world growing up to be would be crazy or pagan. And so I was like, oh, that would be crazy and pagan if I like am talking to plants. And so
The great N. Scott Momaday just passed away recently, right?
I know I'm,
Yeah.
it's such a huge loss. And I love all of his books. Like he's such an incredible writer and a gift to mankind. And I like in one of his introductions, can't remember which book it was too, but he has in there like that Beowulf and the language of Beowulf, being like a an old language of heritage and remembering that. And yeah, that I think he really he's so amazing in opening the door in so many ways, from winning the first Pulitzer for A Housemaid of Dawn and showing natives don't just live on reservations but also in cities and that they go through different things and it's complex. But also like in his work, I think it's evident that connection to land and what our bodies being land can mean as a healing force. And like in this one book, the man who was a bear, or wait, I need to figure out the title because I actually wrote an essay for the Paris Review about Scott Momaday and his works, and he's just so incredible.
Good to get to that point, right, where you forget what the name of the book was for the Paris Review that you wrote. It's a good problem to have, right? Problem.
That's an amazing problem to have. What a crazy life. The Ancient Child, that novel, I love that book, and the what it says about how far can you take land connection and going back in tradition from where we are today without how those things don't operate the same, and that it's a strong medicine. And also at the same time, the power of land and how what that can mean. And so it's like this broader thing of rematriation and reconnection to land and language that I think ultimately empowers like teaching maybe this curriculum worldwide of land protection based on, morality today is like comes from Christian concepts of Christianity in some senses and like being a steward, but it has this idea of property in it. But if like we are able to teach this idea of land protection and responsibility toward land, I think it would change the way that business interests are vested and that we could perhaps like save the world that way. And I think that's all in N. Scott Momaday's work. Like,
Whoa.
yeah, I think he's just so important.
The secret to life, the key to life. I love, love, love that word, rematriation, not repatriation. Love it.
Yeah,
Love it.
they return. They define it. The Hoden some Haudenosaunee women who create have created Rematriation magazine, rematriation.com. They have returned to their lodge ways, and they define it as the return of the sacred to the mother. And it's not just for Native people, it's for everyone. And Natalie Diaz kind of describes it in some of her poems and post-colonial love poem as putting your body in your first waters. And kind of people are so focused today on the idea of guilt or needing to do reparative action, which is very, very important. And but it's only half of it. You can't repair things and work for equity without also addressing your own disinheritance, I think.
Oh,
And
wow.
people have lost their medicine. And like that, we're sick. We have to be healed. And it's everyone's been dispossessed at a different point in time. Some people, it was 2,000 years ago. And it's, we've participated in the westward spread of empire and the Roman Empire and manifest destiny. But that doesn't mean that we don't also need to, those of us who aren't like Black or Native or immigrants now, we were still dispossessed at some point. And it's like everyone needs to participate in this rebalancing to where we're in this power imbalance. And I think rematriation is like the way to do that.
Yeah. Wow. The collection is called A Calm and Normal Heart. We talked about the author's note where you do use the Latinized spellings. You do talk about how some of the spellings vary in the Osage language, but just a really cool way of, you know, revitalizing that practice of including indigenous languages and literature. Every short story has the Osage title as well. Like you said, a lot of people know about the Osage through the movie. And the first short story is called, how would you pronounce that? Texcope?
Sehompe.
I'm sorry, one more time.
Sehompe.
Sehompe. Sehompe.
Sehompe.
And that first paragraph right there is just like, you said earlier that you characterize your own writing as direct, and I felt that was a really direct way to say it. It's so under, I guess, I don't know, understated. And there's so much in the words. The first paragraph, one time between a breakup and a shackup, I went home for a visit. I had most of my stuff in my car, but I didn't really want to move into my aunt's place. So I went to the laundromat to procrastinate. I parked right across the street from the yellow house where my eco used to live all the time she divorced my grandfather. An old man was traveling. There's so much going on. Like, that's like three sentences. Like, you know, your eco used to live all the time she divorced my grandfather. Like, that's so evocative, right? Between a breakup and a shackup, going home. Like, what does that mean? You know, it's just a visit. I didn't really want to move into my aunt's place. You're writing, I keep saying the word evocative, and I'm sorry to be repetitive, but it just really is. I wonder if that story in particular changed with, I know that the movie, the Scorsese movies, has been talked about for a year, like, I mean, a pretty good amount of time. It wasn't like it just was foisted on the public, people known about it. I know there was like some rewrites, whether or not they were successful or not, you know, with the Osage people in mind. But I wonder if that particular story, which is where, you know, this woman comes back to her hometown, this small town, there's a lot of kind of like, not gossip necessarily in the negative word, but just kind of everyone knows each other. And it's like, hey, are you part of the film? Are you part of the film, like capital F, capital M. I wonder if this short story like evolved with the way with what you heard about the movie, or just the fact that there was a movie. Does that make sense?
Right.
Like, are you trying to combat some things maybe, or I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I was trying to negotiate, perhaps I was trying to work through with this short story, like how to feel about the film, because at IAIA, it's definitely like super hard on the own voices school, you know, like Native stories by Native business. And I think of that company, Eighth Generation, it's like Native, you know, made, not Native inspired. And what the Osage community, like as a whole, doesn't have one official response toward the movie. There is endorsements of Lily Gladstone and Scott George through our actual Osage Congress. Our chief has spoken on it, our communications office. So like, we do kind of have an official line on the movie. It's like, we support the hundreds of Osages who worked, you know, some paid, some not, to collaborate with Scorsese. To not only did he rewrite the script after meeting Chief Jeffrey Standing Bear and hearing and understanding a little bit more about the Osage people and who we are, but also Like, we made this movie in many ways like a success and what it is. And it's not that it wouldn't have been a success in some other sense had we not done that, but Scorsese also willing to ask us how is he doing, you know? And this was really reflecting Grey Horse, which is, I'm not from that district, I'm from Pawhuska District, and it was focused on kind of what happened in Fairfax and Grey Horse. And so the film basically had a lot of Osage vested interests in it, and love and effort and commitment, and also recognizing that, like I said earlier, when I was young, people didn't know what Osage was. So they're like seeing me and encountering me, they're like, you're not Native American, you're not what I think. And so this film has deep impacts. I haven't even mentioned Osage language being spoken yet, which it is in the film. And so it's not a native told story. It did not have a business model that treated the Osage as a business partner to Scorsese. So it is extractive at the end of the day. That's my opinion. But the Osage people were still treated better than usual. We had a say in how we were portrayed. We played our own selves. And so it's both groundbreaking and not good enough. And I don't usually say just exactly what I think like that, because I don't want to kind of impinge on anyone else's beautiful contributions and what they were able to achieve. But I'm saying this, I think, also because now I've seen how it was received at the Oscars, and there were 10 nominations, and Emma Stone won Poor Things, and she did a good acting job in that movie, but I don't think she had as high of a challenge as Lily Gladstone did in actually the care she took to understand exactly how is an Osage woman, how did she get that just right, to where Flannery O'Connor says your only audience that really matters is your own community, and does it pass there? If it doesn't, it means nothing, it's worthless. And Lily did that, and like Ekyon, she did that. It's crazy. Like, and she learned our language, and just her acting alone is so incredible. She was limited, I think, by maybe not having as much screen time as Emma Stone did. And so I think that I wanted a way to, at the time I was writing this, I had auditioned like most every Osage living in Oklahoma, maybe. And it was just such a thing. And so I was just processing what was happening around me, and also not wanting to, I guess, come out too strong and just be like, you all shouldn't be doing this because this is not a native told story, and I can't believe you're selling out to Scorsese. And I was just trying to be like not that basic and more complicated than that.
Well, I appreciate that nuanced answer. Lily Gladstone doesn't necessarily have a lot of dialogue. I mean, her facial expressions tell so much, right?
Right.
As the movie goes on, as her saga goes on, based on the real life. And the collection is just like that, where the last story, for example, is very much allegorical, mythical, right? A lot, very much nature-based, and like almost like a history of the people. The first story, as we said, deals with the movie, which is, very modern. A lot of old, there's a lot of new, there's a lot of modern, there's a lot of traumas, especially to women. There are women who are victims of incest, victims of rape. There are women who really don't have a lot of agency, and there are many who really claim their agency in different ways. So just like Lily Gladstone's expressions are so say so much. The very direct, efficient writing that you have, it says so much, and I'm saying it one more time, is so evocative.
Thank you so much.
And so I really just want to appreciate you giving, so much context and so much history, which makes its way into the story subtly or not, nuanced or not. And it's just a really impressive collection. Like you said, it's very experimental, and it's also just so thought-provoking, really. So really appreciate your time and your
Can
comments
you
and everything
tell
like that.
me, like, I want insight, like, where does it feel perhaps like more experimental, like beyond? Because I feel like I try to write in this way that's just so, I don't know, like I said, direct. I don't want to be inaccessible, but I want to be myself.
Yeah.
And it's funny, like I remember texting this one ex who was like really polyamorous and busy. And so I was like, I would use the text as a way to try to develop my writing style because I was like, this needs to be so just like, wait, what? Interesting. And I feel like that's where the style in the first story comes from, is it, and it's like also me being really drawn toward poetics and, you know, like
Yeah.
compaction and
Okay.
like surprising language. And so I'm wondering, like I have a novel on submission now, and I have a good feeling about it getting placed soon. And that
Ooh.
style is perhaps, it's basically the same style. Like I think my prose style is more developed at this point to where I'm not changing it a lot, but I'm just wondering, like I'm hoping to understand myself as like an experimental writer, because to me that's not what I am. I'm like, what?
I see what you mean. I see what you mean. Well, ho hopefully give you a not a roundabout answer, but like, well, I do want to ask you like the beginning poem. I mean, I guess you the
Yeah.
beginning poem even before the author's note. I mean, is that yours? Is
Yeah.
that it is, right?
Like I was mentioning, I wrote poems when I was like
Yeah.
younger. I've always loved poetry the most. I've just felt it's the most demanding form. And so, like to me, fiction and well, I won't talk about creative fiction, but fiction just, you know, it's coming out, it's working, it's coming, it's almost channeling, right? And
Right.
then most of my editing has to do with radical cutting and tuning in again and, you know, revision, so important. But a lot of it is logistical. Like,
Sure.
I think fiction is highly logistical.
Okay.
And poetry is not the same. Poetry requires a level of listening to me and presence that's a bit different.
Yeah.
And so I'm really interested in both forms, but poetry to me is like my heart's core. Like,
Oh,
it's my
wow.
biggest love.
Yeah.
And I just approached it slower. Like, I'm actually going to be starting a PhD in creative writing focused on poetry,
Oh,
because
good for you.
I tend to not want to do anything until, you know, it is, I've had enough support where I feel like I'm going to be able to be super strong. I just
Yeah.
tend to stay in the shadows longer. So there's a lot of poetry going on, but I'm kind of keeping it back here because
Sure.
I don't come out till I'm really ready.
Yeah,
So
yeah. Well, just even just on a real basic level, just the fact that you like the experimental or maybe eccentric part is just like having and found poetry is not the word. Having the poem is not necessarily in the action, but there's also I love that one where it's even just including like a graphic. The one where it's like the Roman numeral XI,
Right.
or at the end of the story, it goes from X to
Totally.
X. It's like a return to like a, what's the word? Like, not, I'm going to say homogeneous, but that's not the term. What do you call it? It's like a balances, homeostasis type of thing, right?
Cool.
But just so much about community as well. So yeah. And I love like the banter, like you talk about in that first story, the banter between the narrator and the guy that she kind of, I don't think I'm getting the stories mixed up. The one she labels as kind of
Oh,
like
you got it. Yeah.
normcore, right?
That's the one. Normcore native cool.
But I see a lot of that experimental in the conversations and
Okay.
what's being said and what's not being said. And
Right.
in that case, it doesn't seem to me like a lot of the dialogue is indirect,
Right.
right?
Yeah, I guess in fiction right now, like there's this trend, or as I'm processing it, it's like to focus on what the character is thinking and perhaps thoughts that we would consider taboo or not sayable in our highly charged, like po polite, reforming contemporary society where we're trying to have greater integration, and like we're trying to move away from racism, and we have anti-racism initiatives, and so like people's thoughts are precious today because they're more heavily guarded than maybe in the 50s when people
Ah,
were just
interesting.
saying whatever. And so in fiction right now, I'm seeing this focus on what is the character thinking worked out in great intimate detail. And I do have interiority for my characters, but I was so kind of beaten over the head for so long. Like, we don't want to hear what they're thinking, like, have them do something. And so maybe I'm just still recovering from that.
Well, maybe end with this great quote. This is forgetting the narrator's name. Oh, Mary, I want to say, and she's talking to Joy. This is the one about their kind of spending. They're kind of doing a Friendsgiving kind of instead of Thanksgiving because of the, inherent obviously negativity based on the history of, Native Americans. And she says to Joy, who becomes kind of like a found community for her because at the very least the dude Darren is shady at the very least. Kind of iffy, but she's but Mary says to Joy, quote, "What I hate most in the whole wide world right now is I feel like I live in a different country that's here inside this one, but no one believes my country exists." I mean, that's interiority right there. That kind of comes out for the reader, that comes out for the character. Yeah.
Well, thank you for bringing that out and for being such a close and caring reader of so many authors. Like, I'm a big admirer of your podcast, and it's really cool to be on here. So thank you so much, Peter.
The pleasure is mine. The honor is all mine to be able to speak to such intelligent and thoughtful and reflective people. So thanks so much, and great luck with the PhD. And by the time the novel comes out, maybe you'll be a doctor, and I'll talk to you then as Dr. Chelsea Hicks.
Maybe so. All right, Peter.
Take
Well,
care.
I'll tell your students hi, and
Awesome.
Godspeed out there.
Thank you so much. Same to you. What a pleasure it has been to speak with Chelsea T. Hicks. Continued good luck to her with her writing and her important work. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Chills of Wood podcast. You can now subscribe on Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also ask for the podcast by name using Alexa and find it on Stitcher, Spotify, and on Amazon Music. Follow me on Instagram where I'm at Chills at Will Podcast or on Twitter where I'm at Chills at Will PO1, the digit 1. You can watch this and other episodes on YouTube. Watch and subscribe to the Chills at Will Podcast channel. I'm very excited to have one or two episodes per month featured on the website of Chicago Review of Books. The audio will be posted along with a written interview culled from the audio. A big thanks to Rachel Leon and Michael Welch at Chicago Review. I'm looking forward to the partnership. You can check out my recent interview with Gina Chung on the website. Sign up now for the Chills of Will podcast Patreon. It can be found at patreon.com/chillsatwillpodcastpeterreal. My conversation with Chelsea and my recent conversation with Jenny Croft really got me thinking a lot about language and translation, which, shoot, I'm always thinking about those things as a Spanish and English teacher and a reader. But they really got me thinking about translation, what is lost, what is gained, what has changed. And also in talking with Jenny, we talked a lot about Argentina and Jorge Luis Borges. The latest Patreon bonus episode deals with a story that you have to read. In Spanish, it is El Evangelio según Marcos. It is the Gospel according to Mark. I do an analysis and a deep dive into that story and talk about ideas of translation. That's Patreon. You can check out the page that describes the benefits of a Patreon membership, including cool swag and bonus episodes. Thanks in advance for supporting my one-man show, my DIY podcast, and my extensive reading, research, editing, and promoting to keep this independent podcast pumping out high-quality content. I've added a $1 a month tier for well-wishers and cheerleaders of the show. Thanks to new Patreon member Jessica Cuello, herself a talented poet and former podcast guest. The Chills at Will podcast is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look at an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills at Will podcast is Wind Down Instrumental, and the other song played on the episode was Hoop Instrumental by Matt Whitehour, and both songs are used through archesaudio.com. Please tune in for episode 231 with Jasmina Barrera Velasquez, who is a fellow at the Foundation for Mexican Letters. Her book of essays, Cuerpo Extraño, was awarded the Latin American Voices Prize from Literal Publishing in 2013, and she is the editor and co-founder of Ediciones Antílope and author of, most recently, Cross Stitch. The episode will go live on April 16th or April 17th. Lastly, please go to ceasefiretoday.com, which features 10-plus actions to help bring about ceasefire in Gaza. For now, thanks again for listening. I hope that these uncertain days bring you texts by writers with mad skills, like Chelsea T. Higgs, whose work, like a calm and normal heart, gives you chills at will.